This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for a look at life in the developing world. On this week's program, Kenya in crisis. We hear the latest. And meet Marya Aman, a Palestinian child paralyzed by Israeli shrapnel. Marya's in a hospital in Jerusalem, but may have to leave. Her father is fighting for her to stay.
They have to take care of us. We've gone through enough. Marya is 6 years old. What did she do? Does she understand what war is?
Also, going cold turkey in Turkey. Farmers there quit growing illegal opium.
Anyone caught breaking the rules has his whole family banned from growing the crop for life. And anyone involved in the heroin trade faces a minimum 20 years imprisonment.
It's all coming up on the World Vision Report. Kenya's presidential election has sparked widespread anger and ethnic violence. The incumbent president, Mwai Kibaki, narrowly won the election. But the opposition claims the results were rigged. Kibaki is from the dominant Kikuyu tribe. The opposition is made up of smaller tribes that tend to be poorer and less powerful. More than 600 people have been murdered, and 250,000 people have been left homeless. The Red Cross is calling the post-election chaos in Kenya a humanitarian disaster. Richard Locke is our Africa correspondent. He's on the line with us now from Nairobi. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you.
I understand, Richard, you've just come back from visiting some of the camps where so many displaced people have fled. Can you tell us a little about what it was like there in the camps?
That's right. I recently visited Jamhuri Park, which is on the outskirts of Nairobi, and it's where about 4,500 displaced people have gathered, and they've come from the neighboring slum of Kibera, which is home to near on a million people, many of whom come from the Luo tribe. That's the tribe of opposition leader Raila Odinga, and they're the ones who have been pushed out of the slum. Others have just been caught up innocently in the crossfire in between the fighting. Many of them have lost their houses. Houses have been burned. Markets have been torched. People have been subjected to machete attacks, and women, unfortunately, have been raped. They've been assisted by the Red Cross, who've been handing out blankets. They've been handing out some secondhand clothing and also some basic foodstuffs.
Is there enough aid getting to the tens of thousands of displaced people right now?
Well, this humanitarian aid is now beginning to trickle through, but there's still a lot more work to do. That work originally hampered by roadblocks across the country and the closure of the port of Mombasa. But the Red Cross say they are still unable to reach some people in certain parts of the country, people who may be injured, others who are hungry and in desperate need of clean drinking water.
Why is so much of this violence centered in the Kibera slum where so many poor people live? Can you help us understand these tribal tensions there?
It's not just the Kibera slum. I mean, Nairobi is home to several fairly notorious slums. On the other side of the city, we have the Mathari slum that is home to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Luo people. And these slums are a hotbed of opposition support. And they feel that they have had this election stolen from them. It is President Mwai Kibaki who is re-elected, and he is a Kikuyu. And the Kikuyu have really been the politically and economically most influential tribe. This time, with their leader, Raila Odinga, the Luo really thought they had a chance of having their first president. They reckon they've had the election taken away from them, and they're very, very angry. And they've taken this anger out on tribes they believe support President Kibaki.
Now, Richard, one thing that surprised people is that Kenya is actually one of the most stable democracies in Africa, economically very viable. Other countries look to Kenya for strength and support. And so this kind of violent outburst is very destabilizing and very surprising. Is it really just this election that would trigger this?
No, you're quite right, Peggy. These ethnic tensions are deep-seated, as in so many African countries. And don't forget, Kenya and its neighbors were drawn up by colonial powers who really just drew straight lines across a map with scant regard for the ethnic makeup of the countries they were creating. And as you say, Kenya has hitherto been a very, very stable democracy. Kenya has always played a mediatory role in Somalia, in Sudan. It's helped out other neighbors. And Kenyans have been fiercely proud of that tradition. And they're now very ashamed of the fact that international mediators are now coming to their country to sort out their own problems.
Kenya has been a strong democracy and pretty strong economically in the region. What does this mean for Kenya? I've heard that it's really crippling economically.
That's right. Economically, this is crippling. As you say, it's estimated this crisis is costing Kenya $30 million a day. Tourism is the biggest foreign exchange earner for this country. Cancellations are very high. We're hearing as high as 50% in some parts of the country. So the knock-on effect will continue. It's not just having an effect on Kenya, though. It's also having a regional impact. There's effectively only one road from the port of Mombasa on Kenya's coast that goes through to Uganda, southern Sudan, and the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, that road has effectively been shut off for the last 10 days, and so knock-on effects also being felt in those countries. In Uganda, where I used to live, fuel prices have shot up, and many people now aren't able to get around the country.
Mm. So there's really a terrible ripple effect for the region.
A very pronounced ripple effect, and Kenya's neighbors looking to Kenya really for a quick solution so that economic life can resume as normal.
Okay, Richard Locke, our reporter in Africa, thank you so much for joining us today.
That's a pleasure.
We now go to another trouble spot, one that's in the news more often, the Gaza Strip. Here, the Israeli Air Force sometimes carries out what have been called targeted assassinations. They shoot missiles at militants who attack Israel. But sometimes the target isn't the only one hit. On May 20th, 2006, 6-year-old Maria Aman was hurt in such an attack. She was paralyzed from the neck down. Today, Maria's being cared for in a Jerusalem hospital. But Israeli officials want to send the family to the West Bank. Friends and advocates say that's like issuing Maria a death sentence. From a hospital in Jerusalem, Daniel Estrin has this report.
This beeping sound signals that Maria has been disconnected from her respirator. Her head is tilted back and she's staring up towards the ceiling. Maria's father has removed the breathing tube from the hole in her neck so he can clean out her airway. But it's a race against the clock as he uses the suction wand. 50 seconds without oxygen, and she'll start turning blue.
24 hours a day, I take care of her.
Hamdi Aman is 30 years old, and his dark eyes are wide and focused. He's worked as a waiter, a taxi driver, and a construction worker, but now, taking care of his daughter is his full-time job. Maria was injured in May 2006. She was with her family taking a ride in their uncle's new car. The driver in the car next to them was a member of Islamic Jihad. An Israeli Air Force pilot shot 2 missiles at the militant's car and killed him. Shrapnel from the missiles killed Maria's mother, older brother, grandmother, and uncle. Maria's spinal cord was severed, and she was rushed to an Israeli hospital. She's now paralyzed from the neck down. A few weeks after the attack, Aman got permission from Israeli authorities to visit Maria. Since then, he hasn't left her side. He now lives in the hospital with Maria and his 4-year-old son. Yes, they live in the hospital, in a small room on the first floor.
My day always starts early. It's 6 a.m. I bathe her, dress her, and put her in the wheelchair. Then I shower my son, change his clothes, and feed them. The boy goes to kindergarten, and Maria comes to school to learn for a few hours.
The Israeli government pays for a handicapped accessible van to drive Maria and her father to a mixed Arab-Jewish school in Jerusalem. In the first grade classroom, Maria uses her chin to guide a computer joystick. First, she opens a drawing program. Then, with slight calculated movements of her chin, she draws out the Arabic letters on the screen. Her father helps her spell out her last name. Okay, write Aman, her father says. How? Maria asks. And then her father spells out the letters for her.
Alif.
Alif.
Uma. Unun.
Maria leaves school early to return to the hospital for routine care and an afternoon nap. But this routine may soon come to an end.
They are Palestinian, and I think they should live in the Palestinian Authority.
That's Shlomo Dror, the spokesman for the Israeli Defense Ministry. It's been covering the hospital bills and giving the family a monthly allowance, but now that Maria is stable enough to move to a home environment, the The ministry wants to send the family back to the Palestinian Authority, although it's pledged to continue to pay for Maria's medical needs. Dror says the Israeli government has already done plenty to help the family.
The family think that this is the responsibility of Israel to take care of the family. But it's a question of international law. According to the international law, we don't have to take responsibility for this family. We are in a war with the Palestinians. I didn't see that the Palestinian Authority coming to all these Israelis that wounded or killed during the Intifada and taking responsibility to any one of them.
The Defense Ministry wants to move the family, not to their home in the Gaza Strip, but to the West Bank, where conditions are better. But Hamdi Amman says the best medical care for his daughter is in Jerusalem, so he's appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court, asking the government to grant them permanent residence in Israel.
To tell you straight, they have to take care of us. We've gone through enough. Enough. What did I do to anyone? Maria is 6 years old. What did she do? Does she understand what war is?
Critics of the move say that many Palestinian children have been injured during Israeli army operations in the Palestinian territories. They suspect that the government doesn't want to set a precedent that would open the floodgates for thousands of Palestinians to demand residence in Israel. But Shlomo Dror, the Israel Defense Ministry spokesman, puts it this way: Maria shouldn't be treated any differently than other Palestinians who receive medical care in Israel.
There are thousands of people coming every day to get medical treatment in Israel, and when they finish the treatment, they go back home.
But Maria's advocates worry if there's an emergency, she won't live long enough to get through a West Bank military checkpoint. Dalia Becker is one of them.
To throw Maria away from Israel, it's like you say, Maria, go to hell and go to die.
Becker is a 52-year-old Israeli who visits Maria and her family every day. When she read about Maria in the paper, she helped organize a network of volunteers.
He's not alone. We are his family in Israel, because his family in Gaza, it's very difficult for them to come. So we are the family.
It's evening time in the hospital room, and Dalia and Maria are playing make-believe tea time. Maria has baked an invisible cake with grapes for the occasion, and she's taking tea orders from her brother and father. He says he doesn't have the heart to tell Maria that she'll be paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of her life.
She always dreams. You ask her, what do you want, Maria? She says, I want a house. She thinks she'll shower by herself, cook us food, clean the house.
Maria yells to the computer screen as she chats with her aunt in Gaza over an internet video connection. I'm doing fine, she says. The Israeli Supreme Court is scheduled to rule on the family's petition to remain in Israel on February 11th. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Afghanistan is the world's biggest producer of opium. U.S. troops have tried to curtail production on the poppy farms, but with little success. 30 years ago, Turkey was also a major source of opium, and much of the heroin on Western streets came from there. But a major crackdown changed all that. Under strict controls, poppies are now grown legally and sold for medical use. Poppy farmers are happy, and so are government officials. So could this be a model for reforming Afghanistan's opium trade? Some experts are hoping that's the case. Dorian Jones reports from the heart of opium country in southwest Turkey.
Mohammed Duan chats with pride as fellow farmers congratulate him on his rich poppy fields. The consensus is it's going to be a good opium year, and they should know. All these farmers have been growing opium for more than 50 years. Duan, white-haired and deeply tanned from decades of tending his poppies, explains opium is more than just a cash crop.
My father, my grandfather, and his grandfather have all grown the opium poppy. I started as a child. I grew up in the opium fields. It is part of my blood. We use the poppies in our food, the oil to cook our food. Even the cattle eat the stems. That's why our milk tastes so good. Opium is part of who we are.
The farmers are here to meet with government inspector Ilyas Mert. The Turkish government will buy their poppies, which will eventually be processed into pharmaceutical products like morphine and codeine. Not much gets past Mert, who's been in the opium regulation business for 30 years. Mert carefully checks the plants to ensure their round buds haven't been cut, a sign that the farmer has illegally extracted opium paste from them. Careful calculations are made on how much opium Doğan's fields will yield. Any discrepancy with what is actually delivered will immediately result in an investigation. With Mert satisfied that everything on this farm is in order, he quickly leaves to visit the next opium farm. It's almost harvest time, so this is a busy season. Mert is on his way to Doğan's brother, Ali. He says nearly everyone in this region is involved in some way with opium production. But the penalties for breaking the rules are stiff.
Anyone caught breaking the rules has his whole family banned from growing the crop for life. And anyone involved in the heroin trade faces a minimum 20 years imprisonment. But the key to success is working with the local people. So all our inspections are done with respected elders in the community. This is crucial. Everyone realizes that opium production can only succeed if there is no one entering the heroin trade.
Winning that trust both at home and abroad has been a long battle. 30 years ago, the Turkish government, under intense pressure from the US, took the draconian step of banning all opium production in the country. Farmer Ali Doğan remembers those hard days.
It was a terrible time. There was great unhappiness, hunger, and anger. We never want to go back to those times.
The three-year ban was lifted in 1974 after a public backlash which exploded into civil unrest. That's when the stringent controls were put in place.
Of course, every farmer would like to grow more, but why would I risk me and my family being banned for life?
The world's biggest opium factory is a short drive from Ali's field. It processes half the world's legally cultivated opium poppies, and it stays open 24/7. Opium buds are shoveled into a huge processor where opium paste is extracted. Government officials here say Turkey has completely eliminated illegal opium cultivation. That success has led to some anti-narcotics experts to suggest Turkey's regulations could be a model for Afghanistan. But Afghanistan produces more opium than the rest of the world combined. So at this point, there simply wouldn't be enough pharmaceutical markets to absorb all of it. In any event, the security situation in Afghanistan would have to greatly improve before a system similar to Turkey's could ever hope to succeed. Back on the farm, the Doğan brothers and their fellow opium farmers take a break. As they drink their sweet, strong tea, they say they're looking forward to harvest time. Mohammed admits that in the past, when there were fewer regulations, his family earned more. But he adds it's a small price to pay for the freedom to cultivate his beloved opium poppies.
Every morning when I see these beautiful fields of opium flowers, all my stress disappears and I feel such happiness. I cannot survive without seeing this.
Mohammed says his grandfather taught him how to grow opium, and now he's teaching his own grandson. Opium, he says with a smile, is his family's life. For the World Vision Report, I'm Doreen Jones in Afyon, Turkey.
In Afghanistan, in an office belonging to Katrine Fakiri, there's a framed picture of her standing next to a smiling Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. The photo takes center stage among various certificates and awards Fakiri has won for her work in Afghanistan. Fakiri's organization gives small, low-interest loans to poor women who want to open their own businesses. But as reporter Fariba Nawa explains, Fakiri's life was very different just a few years ago.
In 2003, she was climbing the corporate ladder in a high-tech company in Silicon Valley. Then a philanthropist couple in the Bay Area approached her with the idea of starting a microcredit organization in Afghanistan. It had been 22 years since she'd seen her birthplace, but Fikiri decided to take up the challenge.
I thought I would start this microcredit organization because the idea of microfinance really appealed to me. The idea that it's not free money, it's not charity, it's actually an empowerment program.
The 35-year-old named the organization Parwaz, which means to fly in Dedi. For the first 2 years, Fikiri worked for free, but the sacrifice has paid off. In the last 4 years, the group has lent 9,000 women money to start businesses ranging from tailoring to carpentry. Three young women sit around a table and cut clothing patterns as their instructor looks on. The girls in the sewing class are all disabled in some way. The classes are sponsored by the women's cooperative that sells handicrafts. Several months ago, Parwaz lent the business $540 to move the shops from private homes into this two-story building. The women are already paying back the loan. Nazifa is one of the students here today. The 22-year-old cannot walk, but she can use her hands.
I come here because I get bored and lonely, and I have fun here. I've made skirts and kids' clothes on paper patterns. I want to be a seamstress and not need others to support me.
Fikiri says she looks to her clients like these for motivation to keep going amidst the challenges of life in Kabul. She has stopped smiling at people, especially men, because it might be perceived as promiscuous. She dresses conservatively in long sleeve tunics over slacks, and she wears a headscarf outside. Fikiri has also lost her sense of safety. As an Afghan-American woman heading a women's program, she's a target for the conservative insurgency who kidnaps and kills foreigners in Afghanistan.
I've lost my freedom, essentially. Freedom of movement, freedom to wear what I want, freedom to be myself. You know, I'm a friendly person who is social. I would interact with men and women. For me, it was no problem. Whereas here, I have to watch like what I say and what I wear and what I do, where I go. For example, I can't go for a walk. It's just not done here. If I'm going to go walking, then I have to take one of my guards with me.
But the rewards of her work make the troubles worthwhile, she says.
I think I've gained more than I lost. Well, number one, I've gained an inner sense of peace. I don't feel like such a lost soul anymore because I feel like what I'm doing now is so rewarding for me that no matter how hard my professional life gets, it's helping a few thousand women. And if I can do that, then it's worth it for me to go through this hardship.
There have been other changes for Fikiri since moving back to Kabul. Her one-year-old son, Bahir, plays with his nanny in his room full of toys. 3 years ago, Fikiri married an Afghan Frenchman she met in Kabul. She visits her family in the Bay Area once or twice a year, but Fikiri says right now she has no intention of leaving Kabul.
My biggest concern is security, and that's it. Yeah, one and only. If it wasn't for the security issue, I could say I could live here for probably the rest of my life.
For the World Vision Report, this is Fariba Nawa in Kabul, Afghanistan.
Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, is now in prison in The Hague. His trial for crimes against humanity during Liberia's civil war is scheduled to begin later this month. Taylor was infamous for his brutality and for using child soldiers in his army. William Powers was an aid worker in Liberia during the Civil War. In this aid worker diary, he tells us about two very different encounters he had with child soldiers.
During the war, I sometimes delivered food to people starving in the country's southeast jungles. On one such trip, I was stopped by one of Taylor's soldiers, a teenager, at a makeshift roadblock. He pointed an AK-47 at my driver's head. But he was looking at me. "Get down," he demanded. "This is how it happens," I thought. "This is how you die." The soldier was a member of Taylor's notorious small boys unit. Most of them had been kidnapped as children and had grown up in the militia. In a civil war known for its cruelty, they stood out. "Get down," the soldier said to me again, sweat pouring into his bloodshot eyes. But I couldn't move. I heard branches snap as monkeys crashed in the rainforest canopy. I felt immobilized by fear. My driver took charge. "Why you gotta bother the boss man, Ol? This official NGO vehicle." The man with the gun responded by slipping his sweaty finger over the trigger. He pointed the weapon tip at me and then at the door. I opened it. I had no choice but to get down. A thought flashed through my mind. There's no humanity left in him. He is going to kill me. "Wait," my driver said. He pulled a thick wad of bright red Liberty notes, Liberia's currency, from his pocket. The soldier's face changed slightly. He reached out to accept the blazing red wad. Gun in one hand, money in the other, I noticed how young he was. He suddenly looked like any other teenager. My fear turned to a hot compassion. A year later, I was back in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, where I met a former child soldier. Stephen was 19 and admitted he'd done terrible things, including killing people. Before I met Stephen, I'd been a skeptic that such boys could ever be rehabilitated back into society. After all, I'd seen child soldiers in action. Some wounds, I figured, would never heal. But Stephen had been in counseling and job training. He'd become a carpenter, and I met him while he was working on a construction site. He flashed a wad of red Liberty notes, part of his salary, and told me his life had changed. Stephen said he'd found a kind of atonement in his work. "I'm rebuilding Liberia," he told me as he laid a brick. "A family will live in this house. They'll be happy." In that moment, I didn't know how deep Stephen's wounds were, or whether he would ever completely heal from them. And I wondered about that other boy back in the jungle, whether he'd found some healing too.
William Powers is author of Blue Clay People, Seasons on Africa's Fragile Edge. It's now out in paperback. And that brings us to the end of our show today. You can listen to the World Vision Report anytime on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can also podcast the program and listen at your leisure. Our radio team includes Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Cynthia Graber, and Lita Hartman. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.